Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. In 2012, Scottish writer and performer Kieran Hurley premiered Beats, a show about the 1994 Criminal Order and Public Justice Act that banned outdoor rave parties in the UK. Unusually at the time, this monologue was performed with a live accompaniment from a DJ on a bare stage containing only a desk with a lamp. At a crucial moment, using a skillful manipulation of the beats, the DJ obtained our collective visceral synchronization and sympathy with the protagonist momentarily on the wrong side of the law. This was a powerful example of a process known in biomusicology as entrainment. Although Beats ignited the imaginations of Steven Soderbergh and Brian Welsh and was made into a successful feature film in 2019, its core strength remains the fact that it was conceived and originally realized as a piece of live performance. In the conversation that follows, Kieran Hurley reveals the early origins of Beats at the multi-arts centre The Arches in Glasgow, and the significance of the material conditions of its conception. He places his work within a genealogy of a number of other projects that preceded and followed on from Beats, and the way in which his specific way of working as a theatre maker evolved in and outside of the institutional playwriting practices. This conversation took place between Glasgow and London on Zoom on the 8th of May 2020.
The purpose of this conversation is really just to try and understand where you come from as an artist, so to speak. Sure. Because I'm really interested to look at the relationship between the work mm-hmm. and the maker's formative influences, the journey you've been on, training you've received. I'd actually like to go back all the way back to Kieran discovering theatre and performance for the first time. And how did that come about?
So I didn't ever have any clear-headed aspirations to be a playwright, when I was younger, in my teens or early 20s or anything like that. I had a very engaged and dedicated drama teacher in the school that I went to. I didn't grow up in a house where we went to the theatre all the time, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Have been a mental idea. You know, my dad did, when I was properly wee, to take us on a wander up the Royal Mile during August when there was fire eaters and unicyclists about, just to be get a sense of spectacle or something. And, you know, I had a sense of live performance or something through all of that, I guess. But the theatre thing is, I went to a school called Holyrood High School in Edinburgh, which is just a fairly run-of-the-mill state school in Edinburgh. It's a Catholic school. And they just had a uncharacteristically strong drama department for the type of school that it was. And I think that was partly because the teachers there were very good. So people were encouraged to do drama at my school.
What were formative influences? And not just in terms of theatre and performance, but more widely in terms of musical taste or...
What kind of music did I like growing up or what?
Especially if it is relevant, if it has then fed into your work.
Yeah. Obviously, some of the work is really clear. So in Beats, that is a show that was born of a kind of dual interest at the time. I was young when I wrote that. It was on the second, I'd written one monologue piece before that called Hitch, and then that was the second one that I'd done. And I was, at the time, really interested in into electronic music, and I worked in the Arches, and I was one of the front of house staff at the Arches was made up, you could almost split it down the middle between the people that kind of wound up in that job because they were interested in electronic music and house music and techno, and the people that were in that job because they were into experimental performance and the work of Anne Liv Young and stuff, and so I was probably one of the few people that worked there that was sort of into both at that time in my life.
Was this before or after uni or during?
I worked at the Arches during uni, and then after uni as well. But so in making beats, I was interested in electronic music. I was interested in the histories and subcultures of it all. And I was interested in the rave scene from that point of view. But I was also more involved at the time, I guess, in communities around grassroots, anti-capitalist politics, right, and direct action and stuff. And so I guess I was also conscious of a kind of direct action protest history that went back to 1994 and the Criminal Justice Bill, as you know, things that were born out of that scene, like Reclaim the Streets and the party protest sort of culture and everything. And so I was just kind of interested in that political moment, right, from like a number of angles. So on one level, the music is an influence there as a way in, but it was also almost any of my shows or plays probably start with like a specific social question, or so Beats was no different really. It wasn't just like, I want to make a show about rave music. And I suppose the musical influences thing, I had a conversation once that sums something up, where the two of us hit upon the fact that like we probably got into theatre, into making devised theatre, which is sort of where I started, due to being the kind of people that kind of maybe on some subconscious level wanted to be in a band but couldn't play an instrument or sing, right? Rather than being like this specific musical influence, like I make theatre because of Aphex Twin, because of some obscure reason, right? It's more like there's something of all of that that is in why I make work, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Like in the first show that I made, that was a solo show, which was a show called Hitch, I got my two mates, Ben and Gav, who at the time were a band called Over the Wall, to perform on stage live with me, like, and play their music that I really liked. Like, a band. It was just like putting myself in their band. It's really a weird thing to do. It worked. It was like, they were great. But like, and then there's another show called Rantin' that's like really music driven. So obviously part of that is like, that's a trope amongst sort of like male contemporary performance makers. And obviously part of that is some garage band like ego thing, right? But then the other part of it is because something about how when a rehearsal room is structured like a band's practice room, there's something about the kind of work that happens in that space creatively that is really meaningful to me in terms of that space of shared collaboration and live encounter between, I mean, there might be, even in a band practice room, in fact, there often is, someone leading that process. You know, there might well be a lead artist who's responsible for the direction of the work. Mm-hmm. But there's still something about the openness of what can be created in that space. And there's something about its relationship with an audience as well that like lacks a set of pretensions. So I don't know. There's a whole bunch of stuff about why I think a band's process as analogous for a bunch of theatre makers in a room together is can be really useful. That isn't just like, I want to meet a band. You know what I mean? Like, I do actually think it's a useful way of thinking through stuff. And to be honest, it's one of the things that I find hard now that most of my work is bound up in sort of the structures of more traditional playwriting and like the commissioning model of more traditional playwriting, as well as writing in other forms for other media like screenwriting and stuff. Like, I have less and less and less of that time for that kind of creative space now, and I really miss it.
So going back to the influence of the drama teachers from your school, what then took you into, I understand you studied drama. Is it drama? Was it called drama?
I did theatre studies at Glasgow Uni.
To what extent was like that, if we may call it training, which was primarily academic, but then also had other aspects to it that you received at Glasgow University, mm-hmm. formative or relevant to the way in which you then proceeded to make theatre?
Completely formative, but in a bunch of like adjacent ways, but at the same time, utterly formative. So the university experience provided a context for my life in which I could meet other people that were also interested in theatre and sometimes interested in it from similar angles to me, or that were exploring things that I found interesting and exciting. And we could make work together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the work that we were introduced to on our course could provide a stimulus for making that work. And then having made that work, we could make enough of a noise about ourselves to begin to forge some kind of social professional connections with organisations that no longer exist now. That like, okay, cool, here's the people that run the Arches, and they had us come and do a show at their scratch night. They had us come and do 10 minutes of stuff. And now I work there, and now I'm tearing tickets at Arches Live. And so I know everyone who... So all of that is the stuff that makes the first beginning building blocks of an artistic career, I think. Mm-hmm. Or that begins to first open the doors that are necessary to be opened for that career to be able to happen. It's all structural. It's so much more about that, about the relationships and about the structures of power that hold those relationships and about the points at which you get permission to move through them than it is about, like, do you know what? I read The Crucible and I just thought, wow. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like so much more about that. That's what the training. And so, and of course, there's all sorts of problematic stuff connected to that, but that's how it works. You know what I mean? Because then it's the kids that are doing theatre studies at Glasgow University that then have that access point. Like, that's deeply, deeply fucked. But that is how I had that access point. So, but in terms of like more kind of practice based or ideas based, like, we made a big gang and we called ourselves For We Are Many, and there was about 10 of us, and we were all, some of us, I was in first year when we did our first stuff, and some, we went right up to fourth year or recent graduates of that same course. We're sort of like cross year group, like band of like weird theatre devisey people, and we made little happenings and we made theatre shows and we did a whole bunch of stuff without a director, using like fucking climate camp or Occupy style like consensus decision making process hand signals, like around artistic decisions. It was fucking bananas. It was like intensely like horizontal, and it was almost like theatre against the odds. Like, it really wasn't a sensible way to try and make a show, and some of the work was definitely, definitely questionable. But some of what came out of it was like all right, or like kind of like there was something exciting enough about like young people trying to figure this stuff out. And the course was important because it put those people together in the same place. And then the course was important because it also said to those people, look, here's Forced Entertainment and here's the Wooster Group, go nuts. And of course, like being 19, 20, 21, we sort of behaved as if we were the first, you know, 20-year-olds to ape the fucking Wooster Group. Do you know what I mean? Like, but like, of course, like whatever, but it was still important. Yeah, there's something about how intensely collaborative all that was in terms of where I first cut my teeth making theatre that has informed everything I've ever done since, or has informed my understanding of how things work since. Mm-hmm. I think you have people that have really quite well established careers well into their 30s and 40s in theatre that still haven't properly, especially like writers maybe, like who still haven't properly grasped the idea that it's a team sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, and that's mad to me, but that's because their way in has been completely different, and because their value shaping experiences have affirmed their own. That, do you know what I mean? Like, so the course was completely fundamental, but it wasn't because this class or this class or this class that had brilliant teachers. And there's something from all of these. There's loads of different things that I could pull out that have informed what I've done. But the course itself, if you're looking at just, and not the stuff around it, but just the course is a training in theatre scholarship, mm-hmm. not training in theatre practice. That's useful, like it gives you a bunch of stuff, but in terms of what it's setting you up for, the practice bit is the bit that you're doing on your own terms, really. Dee Hedden ran a course called Autobiography and Performance that was quite formative because it gave me a toolkit for making a solo show. When my big gang that I was making theatre with all just kind of dissipated one year, but it was like, bye, we're going to Australia, or bye, we're off to London, or, you know, I'm not doing any of this anymore, we're off to, you know, do a whole bunch of other much more important and useful and interested in, like, social activism. I just made a solo show, not out of any... Again, that's not because I, like, watched some, like... archive footage of Spalding Gray or whatever. That's just, like, do you know what I mean? It was just because it was much more material than that. It was like I say, my life's a series of decisions made out of not knowing what I'm doing. So make stuff in a gang because, oh, hiya, I'm here and I'm the youngest person in this group, so I'll do what you guys are doing because you seem cool, right? And the gang disappears and it's like, make something on my own, I guess, because I literally don't know what else to do. So I made a solo show, and it was an autobiographical solo show based on a very immediate experience of a hitchhiked to Italy to get to the No G8 protests there and told the story of that journey. So that show was called Hitch.
His red hard hat catches the sun and it flickers in my eyes. He turns to me and says, "Yes, and you are our neighbour now. We've come as far as we can go. The helicopters overhead are lower now. Their rhythmic, mechanical pulsing shakes the air. We breathe and move together. We are pushed back. We sway. I feel a stranger's hand grip my shoulder and pull me back up. We raise our hands in peace. We raise our voices in song. And slowly, slowly, started with a fear, a frustration, a confusion. I'd wake up in the middle of the night unable to sleep, knowing full well that the world was moving in a direction and shifting in a way that was beyond my control and beyond the control of anyone I could reasonably trust. It started with not knowing what my future was, not in the job sense or the life plan sense, but something bigger."
Was that after you graduated?
Yeah, that was the year after I graduated. So that was in 2009 and I graduated in 2008.
And at what point did you then start to think of yourself as a playwright?
When I read the first reviews to that show.
What did they say?
I'm pretty sure Joyce McMillan's review of that show refers to me as a playwright and actor.
Yes, okay.
A review of something earlier that was done at the Arches, I can't remember, but I remember seeing myself described as both a playwright and an actor in the same sentence by Scotland's chief theatre critic in The Scotsman and being like, I don't think I'm either of those things. Or maybe I am then? I don't know. Before then, I thought of myself as someone who made devised theatre and whose way into making devised theatre in a collaborative way where roles were undefined had emerged as being writing text and performing. Those were the two things that I sort of gave to like a big collaborative non-defined roles devising processes. I would always inevitably end up writing text. And in fact, the last show that we made as a group was like a weird bastardized take on a Pirandello play, Right You Are If You Think So, that we called Rigmarole. And that one was co-written by just me and one other guy in the collective, a man called Phil Spencer. So that was like the first one that like had a writing credit. And it was me and one other guy. And so, like, I'd begun to establish a consciousness for myself as some kind of writer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't think of what I was doing as making plays. A playwright wasn't something that really existed as an artistic identity in and around the Arches for those few years.
Yes.
It was live artists. Didn't really have it around me as an idea that I was a playwright.
Yeah.
A theatre critic told me that I was one and I went, well, I guess, all right, then maybe I'm a playwright.
Does that have advantages attached to it? I mean, like, do you think of yourself now as a playwright because that's sort of, that gives you more of a currency? Or do you really feel that something has changed in terms of how you consider, you know, your work and your approach?
I think something's changed in terms of how I consider my work. I think it's also important to notice that, like, to mention that, like, prior all that, so even, like, just in school, like, my way of being interested in theatre was often plays. I just didn't call myself a playwright because that would have been ridiculous. So it's not like I didn't have a consciousness around playwriting. I hadn't clocked it. It's what I'd been doing. So what were the advantages? I kind of touched on it earlier when I mentioned something about a band analogous rehearsal process. And touched on it earlier when I mentioned something about theatre being a team sport. But the disadvantage is easier to talk about. It makes more sense to me because I felt really keenly at that, around about that point, was when I first started getting like playwriting commissions or whatever, I didn't actually feel like I knew how to deliver. I didn't have the craft-based, hard-earned self-confidence to know how to deliver through that process. I had enough people around me telling me that I was good enough and that was validating, right? And a lot of people don't ever get that. And I recognize that that's a privilege. And I recognize there's a whole bunch of reasons why I was afforded that privilege at quite a young age in my 20s. But at the same time, I didn't actually have hard-earned, bleeding-knuckled craft to be able to fall back on that could push me through, that could get me through that. So I was flailing a lot. I felt like I was learning how to do that in full view, in full industry view, not in full audience view. Still, nobody knew who I was or whatever. And that's probably still mostly the case. But like, felt like I was figuring a lot of stuff out at a point where I could have figured it out earlier for the work that I was doing. So that was that was I felt in that that was a moment in my career when I felt inadequately prepared for what I was being asked to do.
What was your first commission?
Yeah, see, the funny thing is, it never really quite works like that. It's easy to look at things in hindsight and be like, this is the chronological order of the plays that happened, because that's the chronological order of the in which they were produced or met an audience or published or whatever. Mm. Like, the first time I was paid to make theatre, to write for theatre, was for a little event that the National Theatre of Scotland did when Angie Boal was an associate producer there, that was kind of drawing inspiration from the Shunt Lounge events that used to be under London Bridge. It was like a kind of like social event, like party nightclub with like performance interventions throughout it. But then the first time I was got like a proper commission, like a playwright commission, like with the full smells and bells and the contract and the minimum terms and all of that, was actually a really open-ended commission that the NTS gave me that I never ever delivered on until a couple of years ago. And you know, the thing is, while at the time I experienced that, what felt like a shortcoming, as a deep personal and professional and creative inadequacy, I would be keen laterally, for the sake of other writers coming through from similar places, not to present it simply as that, because it was also the case that there's a strange power imbalance in the kind of work that the industry expects and wants to make. They create, like, what am I trying to say? It was almost like I'd made a bunch of work and then people were like, we like this really exciting, cool stuff that you're doing. Now, because this is the language that we have, can you do this slightly different thing instead? That's not anyone specifically being that or doing that. That's just the industry doing what it does. It's like, you have done this cool, interesting stuff while no one was telling you what to do. And so now that stuff, we love it. Can it be this thing?
Yes.
Rather than just like, do a big one of those. No one's ever paid me a full professional playwriting commission to write a solo show.
Right.
It's made on a bunch of pulled together small funds for development funding, artistic development funding from the Playwright Studio, and then production money from the Made in Scotland programme, all pulled together very last minute because I was quite frustrated because my work was all bound up in the commissioning model, and I wanted to make a show the way that I knew how to make a show, and I was going to do it under very, very intense circumstances in a really short space of time with very little money, if that's what it had to take, and that is what it had to take. I didn't really know what show I was going to make when I set about on that process. I just had an idea about the apocalypse, and I pulled together enough funds to be able to put some key collaborators in place, but I didn't have any other money, and I couldn't properly pay myself as a writer. I got a bit of money, but I didn't get a commission.
Which one was that one?
Heads Up.
Yeah. And Beats, shall we go back to Beats and how that came about? Because that, in the chronology at least, appears to be the one that came before, and that was quite...
So I did Hitch. No, that's true. Chronologically, that is actually accurate as well in terms of my experience. I made Hitch, and then people went, that was good, and that went better than I expected it to do. And then I was like, okay, I don't know what to do next. I guess I'll make another monologue to find out if I'm actually good at that or not. I got a bit more money and resources this time because I successfully applied for and won the Arches Platform 18 Award, which gave people a bursary of a few thousand pounds, I think £6,000. And that's your production budget. So you're sort of paying everyone out of that to make a show. So yeah, sort of leveled up a bit, I guess, with that, and made another monologue, and this time it wasn't autobiographical, it was going to tell a story. The Arches, after I'd done the Hitch there, asked me what I wanted to do next, and I said, I've got this idea about a rave play. I don't even know if I used the word play then, but I might have done. We're now at the point where I may have said play. And I spoke a bit about 1994 and the Criminal Justice Act, and I spoke a bit about that moment, and I said, I don't know what I want to do with this, but I want to spend some time and make a Kill the Bill piece. I don't know what it is yet. And they said, here's like 500 quid. You can spend like a week like in our basement rehearsal rooms. They had this network of like weird, like no windows basement rooms with like neon strip lights, and like present like a work in progress at Arches Live. And I was like, I'm literally just going to do a week, and it is going to be 20 minutes, and I'm going to have a script in my hands. Like, and they're like, that's fine, you can do that. So that was cool, because that was like a really, you know, before Arches Live had been like a festival of graduate work, and there was a big sense of pressure to like do your show, do you know, instead of being invited to do that and just do a thing. I was like, oh, okay, cool. I felt really supported there. So that was important. Having like I can't stress enough how the show wouldn't have been touched by any other organization in the world. The existence of the show is bound up in a story of the importance of having artist-led or artist-centered organizations with a commitment to unheard artists and new work, and experimental work, like it just is, and cross art form spaces as well. Because we were so basically, I said to them, okay, I'll get Johnny Whoop. So Johnny Whoop was a guy who was a DJ, and he was worked in the bar at the Arches, but he was also a DJ at Death Disco and other stuff. So I just got Johnny in a room. I asked him if he would want to come spend a week with me in a room to like figure out some stuff to do with this show. And we got chatting about music. I knew I wanted a DJ on stage. I just had some instincts around it. We got chatting about it all, and we were playing records and talking and stuff in the basement room of the Arches before I'd written a word, really. So that's part of how it comes about. Like, so the musical journey of the show is like evolving in a kind of really informal conversational way with the story between me and Johnny. But also because he was a techie, so he worked in the bar, but he was also a techie, he was a noise boy in the club. So he would do sound technician in the theatre, and he was also the sound tech in the nightclub. So he's like sound technician for Carl Cox and stuff. Do you know what I mean? So like he knows what he's doing. That meant that even though I was like, look, it's just a script and hand reading, right? It's just script and hand reading. You're going to just essentially just play some tunes and just sit there. And I'm going to read, it'll be like two tunes, right? And I'm going to read for like 15, 20 minutes and that is it. But he knows everyone in the technical department that run the nightclub up above our heads. So he's like, we'll just borrow a bunch of shit because we can, right? And you've got to understand Johnny's personality to understand how that happens as well. Like, there's unbridled enthusiasm for the idea of making a show about techno, right? Like, and so we ended up in the Arches practice room, which is this tiny little room with these actually, like, I cannot describe these speaker stacks to you, right? Like, these utterly insane speaker stacks that go like halfway to the ceiling on either side of me, and these moving lights. And just like, I'll send you a video of it. It just filled the room with smoke and light, and it was a noise, and it was the most fucking throbbing, intense environment. And I was sat at a desk because I needed somewhere to sit to just read this wee story. Hiya, this is a script in hand reading, but this wee story, like, and that's how the form of the show was hit upon.
So here we are in the Arches practice room in preparation for a work in progress of Beats at Arches Live, which opens tomorrow night. This is DJ Johnny Whoop, who'll be... Yeah, that's... There he is. We're about to give Harry, who's over here, don't know if you can see him, a little demonstration of this epic sound system that we've installed into the tiny practice room. So take it away, Whoop.
After that, we got the Platform 18 Award, and we got to develop the show, and we played around a little bit very early on with the idea that I would be in the space in a different way, that I wouldn't be at this desk, because I was literally just at the desk because I needed somewhere to put a script. In the show, I don't have a script. Heads Up, I put the script in stage and Heads Up, but in Beats, I didn't, but I still had the desk. And it's because we realized how we're in this multi-art form space, it's also a nightclub, but the guy who is the sound technician and DJ in that nightclub is the guy who is the music consultant and co-performer in the show, right? So we end up, by chance, again, hitting upon this form where I'm like, the reason this is exciting is we're pushing at the boundaries of what we expect to happen in a studio theatre. We're equipping a studio theatre as if it's a nightclub, and that feels exciting. So we're definitely going to do that. So now that we've decided we're doing that, what's Kieran doing in the space? And this is working with my co-director, Julia Todman, who is also my wife and frequent collaborator in loads of things. And we're figuring out how I move in this space, and the space is such a sea of light and smoke and sound, particularly when we then later brought in the work of a VJ and visual artist, Jamie Wardrop, who's live mixing visuals behind me. It's a sea of light and smoke and sound, and having this body move around the space, I was completely lost in it. So actually we just brought the desk back, because we're like, that and a desk lamp the weird domesticity of the desk lamp that is constantly on in all of this just provides an anchor. It was not that we didn't think about it. We arrived back at that point after quite a rigorous like rehearsal and making process.
Yeah.
We stumbled upon all that stuff through the chance possibilities that were allowed to happen by having a multi-art form space in a city centre that was also a nightclub that was had a remit to support young artists who didn't know what the hell they were doing and was staffed by people that were willing to go, here's some resources. I don't care that you don't know what you're doing. And that's how that was able to happen. The form of that show wouldn't and couldn't have been hit upon without those very specific conditions that are made possible in that building.
That's really interesting.
I hope so, because I spoke about it for fucking ages.
No, that's great. Because so then what about Heads Up and why you made the decision to then have the script and to do it at the desk again?
So Heads Up, desk again, like it's that thing where you hit upon something. So Hitch, I did a monologue because all my friends had disappeared and because a year prior, Dee had sort of helped me figure out how to tell an autobiographical story on a stage. I did a monologue. Right. Then Beats, I did a monologue because I was like, well, I now have a active working relationship with this form and I want to interrogate it further, which is a fancy way of saying I was going to find out if I booked it or not. And then Heads Up, I had a relationship with the desk. Like, do you know what I mean? And I was like, what else can this thing do? So on one level, I just wanted to get back because the impulse creatively to make the show was about getting back to something that was a different way in to a relationship with an audience and a different way into the work than screenwriting and commissioning led playwriting was allowing me. It felt kind of like I wanted to get back at a desk and do that. That was like an instinct. And I think artistic instincts and impulses before we rationalize them and see where they're coming from are just kind of important to trust sometimes. So I kind of wanted to get back at a desk and do another thing. Then within that, there's something about how the desk, I said it provided an anchor and Beats and Heads Up, it provides a kind of frame where it's so this getting to explore a little bit more about what my body and what I could do there.
You also mix music in that, don't you? You have music on the desk, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, so this is the other thing. So like now that I've gone, okay, so that's what the desk allows me to do as a performer, is kind of what's been fun about the desk. What else does it allow me to do on a practical level? It allows me to put my script there. Awesome. Yeah, so music's been a big thing in a lot of these shows that I've made, in Beats, in Ranton, in Hitch. Hitch, I had a live band on stage. Ranton, we were all kind of a band doing a piece of gig, Kaylee Theatre. Beats, there was a DJ. So with this one, I was thinking about how I could push further the ways in which music could interact with what I was doing as a storyteller. So I worked with MJ McCarthy, who's a composer, musician, and sound designer in theatre. And I was interested in something where I conjured all the sounds from the stage. That was the starting point. But I was interested in the idea of conjuring through sound this living city that I, as storyteller, kill because it's the apocalypse. That's not quite what happens in the show. This relationship with sound becomes something quite different, but that was the beginning of like, how can we do this? So we played around with me having these samplers on stage, these 16 pad samplers. So there's 32 pads all in all, each one of them with a different sound programmed into it and each one with different functions. So sometimes they're a stab, like a one shot, right? Or sometimes it's like a press and hold thing where it'll be rising pitch the longer I hold it and then it stops when I pull my finger away. Or sometimes I hit it and it loops like a drum beat and I have to hit it again for it to stop. So it does do something about, I think, you know, these sounds all being kind of conjured by the storyteller at one in one thing. But it also then created this other more interesting like gestural relationship with the storytelling, something. Bam! Just, you know, like I am, these gestures become not just like sound cues, but they become gestures.
Choreography in some way. Suddenly we have physicality that works on a completely different level, in a completely different way, where it's very minimal.
But I'm working much more from a place that is impulsive in to start with. So it's much more just like, oh, well, I sit at the desk again? I guess so. Cool. What does the desk do? It does this. But that said, I think it is also important and significant to note that the co-director is a guy called Alex Swift, who is amazing. And Alex's influence in the development of that show is absolutely formative. And I don't think it would be the show that it was without his involvement.
So that's really interesting that you are kind of describing, even though, you know, you're making a solo show and you are now a playwright and an actor, according to the critics, you are still nonetheless working in a very deeply collaborative way.
Oh, totally. It's a team sport. Do you know what I mean? Right. I don't know what else to say. Like, it just absolutely is.
So all of those elements you described, such as the sound elements and the physical elements, yeah, are being developed at the same time as you're writing the text.
Yeah. And actually, in some cases, really informing the text itself. There's this passage that's easiest to demonstrate what I mean by this, and maybe a couple of bits actually in Heads Up. There's one bit where the character point of view is the character Mercy, right? The prophet. And obviously it's all written in second person, right? In the you. And there's a bit of text around her that says, "You step into the station full of people." I can't remember the rest of it now, but there's a bit where she steps into the fucking train station. And it's written in such a way that I don't think I would have written it in exactly the same way if I hadn't been doing the kind of work that I've been doing with Alex, looking at the performance style and performance attitude and performance energy of some spoken word poets, right? And hip-hop artists, actually. I'm not going to claim that I was rapping in that show, because I'm not, but a kind of aggressive musicality to the delivery of the text, right, was like flying around, that informed how I wrote the text. And that was then also informed by beginning to play with MJ with these samplers and how they work. And so how does this work with storytelling? Oh, it works as punctuation. Ding, 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 you step into the station. Ding, 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 the station full of people. Ding, 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 ding. Like, so it's written down in the page, like, yeah, I wrote that. But I didn't write that and then soundtrack it with that music. I developed this gestural, like, staccato punctuation of sound with a composer, right? And a kind of, like, attitude around delivery of text with a director. And I knew, and that totally informed how the text was written. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's right. Not, the music isn't coming as wallpaper later, is essentially what I'm saying.
And how did the two directors complement each other?
Really brilliantly, because the way the process ended up working, and this was all kind of pulled together in the ad hoc way in which that show was pulled together, with not quite enough money to pay anyone properly and not enough time for anything, and just doing whatever we could on people's availability, right? I did a lot of the development with Alex, and I did a lot of the, so a lot of that's like, you know, my the post-its and the early stuff and the this, that and the other, and figuring out the language of the piece and who am I in the space and all of that kind of stuff. And then the kind of rehearsal director, seeing it through to once we kind of know kind of what the show is, and then we're in a rehearsal process, seeing it through to performance, mm-hmm. Majority Julia.
So whereas you said earlier Beats was very much prompted by your political concerns.
Yeah.
Would you say there was a political kind of impulse for Heads Up as well?
Or yeah.
Yeah.
Not like in a kind of newspaper headline-y way. Like, it premiered at the Fringe in 2016, which meant that a lot of people read it as like a sort of Brexit thing, I think. Do you know what I mean? Idea of like the world ending or something. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with Brexit really, like at all. The apocalypse in the show, for me, as a starting point, and it doesn't have to be this for anyone that encounters the show or encounters the play, but I guess the interest in telling us an apocalypse narrative comes from a sense, a feeling that we are living kind of existential crisis in ourselves every day, then that sometimes we allow ourselves the space to really notice that. On one level, the apocalypse is analogous for lots of things in that show. On one level, it's analogous for an existential crisis of deep anxiety and social catastrophe that each one of those characters in their own way is living out, right? Like our absolute alienation from ourselves and each other and the complete disaster of that. So in that sense, it's analogous for just how it feels to be in the world, I suppose. But it is also, it's a bit of a weird thing to do as a writer to set up these like dual and like contradictory analogies in the story. But there's also something, and maybe it always feels like this for folk wherever you are, but there's also a great feeling right now, I think, that I actually think coronavirus and all that accentuates as well, of feeling like we're at the end of something. The impulse to write an apocalypse narrative comes from both of those places, comes from it feeling necessary to tell a story about the crisis of now, in terms of what it feels like on an existential level to be alive now in ourselves, and to tell a story about what it might feel like to be at the end of something huge, and therefore on the precipice of something completely unknown.
Great.
It's that K-punk quote that is alluded to actually in the text somewhere about it being easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
So Mark Fisher was a formative influence in some ways too.
Yeah, yes, okay. So while we're looking for formative influences, there's a really direct one from that one observation. Yeah.
To what extent were you conscious of it being also an exploration of authority?
I guess not that conscious. I have authority as a writer there in that moment, and me and my collaborators and my team are setting up the terms of the engagement that fully depend on a whole bunch of prior assumptions that are learned about how this relationship is going to work between spectator and performer in the theatre space. That's all there, but that's always there, right? There's a bit where I guess it's a kind of turning a gun on myself moment. And I guess that, interested to hear what other people read of that, but I guess for me it becomes less about wanting to expose the inherent authority in the relationship between maker and audience. The bit where I mention myself as storyteller in the piece is about bringing the moment into now. For me, it could be about lots of things for other people, but for me it's about bringing the moment into now, into the now of the shared space of the theatre. It's about a way of being able to sit with the crisis that has been reached or made manifest in the story, being not separate from where we all are sat in the room, it being now. And it's also about a kind of admission that each of these characters and their own anxieties that they carry are vehicles for my own anxieties. That's it.
This is a story. It's a story about a city like this one here and now. It's a story about the end of the world. It's a story about me. And it's a story about you.
Yourself in a room full of light and sound, singing in front of thousands of other humans, reaching for you, singing, screaming, reaching. The video on the laptop screen stalls, then buffers, and then plays again. You watch your singular form traverse the enormous empty stage in front of giant white letters spelling out your name in bright lights. You sit outside an upmarket cafe in the centre of town. You wipe red lipstick from the side of your white coffee mug. You don't like leaving marks. You ask your friend if she can hear a weird ringing sound in her ears. Your friend sips on her flat white and shakes her head.
And then, I'm probably going to skip now for a few steps, but then Mouthpiece is a completely different kettle of fish. It's like...
Yeah.
Completely different. It is a play now, in the traverse sense of the word.
Yeah.
What was the impulse for you there, and how did that piece come about?
I guess it comes about. You'll see a pattern of like a lot of these shows or plays. Some of the earliest impulses around it being a reaction against something I'd just recently done, or whatever, or a return to, or something. It's just me figuring out my own class baggage. That's the first starting point in relation to what I do. I mean, it's set in Edinburgh, which is where I'm from. It's about a writer, which is what I am. I'd been conscious that I'd written a bunch of characters, a little like Declan. I grew up in a part of town where I went to school with a lot of guys like Declan, but I had the social capital and privilege that allowed me to go to university as the second generation in my family. So I'm not Libby. I didn't have the upbringing that she had, but I'm middle class. So I'm in a position where I can write, I think, with truth around people that have been a huge part of my value shaping experiences in my formative years to make it into my place. There's a tension there, isn't there? Right? So that tension is something that I wanted to explore a wee bit. Now, I really, really hope, and I think it's sometimes it actually maybe does do this in a way that I'm uncomfortable with, but I really, really hope that the majority of people that engage with Mouthpiece don't take from it the idea that people can and should only write about directly their own experience, because I think that's bollocks and I think it's dangerous, actually. And I think that is absolutely not a writer's job. Right? And I think a writer's job is to imagine experiences beyond their own. And that has the way to do that ethically is also the way to do that well, artistically, and that is a commitment to empathy and research.
And at what point did you know that it was going to be about the Traverse Theatre itself as well?
You kind of see and work prior to that, that's a thing that I want to do. You know, that I want us to notice the here and now of where we are in the room, and for our relationship to the work to not just be strictly representational.
So it's kind of still holding on in some ways to the legacy of your kind of work that's been rooted in the performance and live art, if you like.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess you could say that. And that's not any more complicated than just like I have my impulses as a writer and a maker, and they are what they are, and they are formed by that. They're informed by that space, and so they still exist in this space. It's not like me going, I will make a claim for the legacy of this work. It's just like that's just what I wanted to do because that's who I am.
Yes, yes.
It's not any more complicated than that.
And how has your work kind of moved on since? What is the balance between works you are writing or developing in response to particular commissions up to work you're making because you want to, and the balance between work that still might honor that interest in music composition in theatre making as opposed to playwriting itself?
So it's tough and informed by a whole bunch of factors, right? One of the factors is, you know, the incredibly fucking volatile nature of the theatre industry. And then you add that on and multiply it by the factor of like having two kids. And then, you know, like it's hard going. And as I say, no one has ever paid me a full theatre commission to make a solo show. I co-wrote a film adaptation of Beats. And so that has provided me with a different strand to my practice as a writer. In screenwriting, and so there's less room for a whole bunch of the stuff that we've spoken about. Me and my partner Julia, who I mentioned we work with like a lot together, have just this year like launched our company. We're calling ourselves Disaster Plan, and it's just a name and a website. We realized that 10 years ago we should have done that, so that when she makes a show we don't have to be like from the makers of Beats. But part of the impulse for doing it now as well as at this point in our lives is just for us really, is it names it, and so therefore we have to maintain it. It's not going to just disappear in like a bunch of like season outline pitch documents for TV drama, or it's not just going to, you know. So our first Disaster Plan show opened at the start of this year, and it's a show that was a Julia show, like, do you know what I mean? It was her show, but I was involved as a dramaturg and involved in a kind of administrative level as well. But that was very, very much driven by the relationship between story and music, and where song and music is instrumental to the dramaturgy and to the form. To be on at the Fringe this year, and it of course will not be. So that's one of our COVID artistic casualties, unfortunately. But you know, next year, hopefully. So that's a space. We don't have that's a Julia show that I've been involved in. We don't have a Kieran show lined up yet, but yeah, there's a commitment to that happening. We've made a commitment to making some work, and who knows what will come of it, because everything feels so fucking unknown right now in terms of where we are as a sector, like month on month. Do you know what I mean? So who knows?
Of course. Great. No, that's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me to have a wee chat.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.